This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, we'll look at the benefits of Cincinnati's growing film industry. Joining me first, Dean Regas. He's been the outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory for 16 years. He's written dozens of articles about the skies above us, co-hosts the popular public television series Stargazers, and now Dean is a published author. His new book is Facts from Space, from super-secret spacecraft to volcanoes in outer space, extraterrestrial facts to blow your mind. The book covers fascinating facts about the solar system and beyond, and includes some interesting details on a wide range of topics, including how to go to the bathroom in zero gravity, and where we should look for aliens. Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Regas joins us to share some of the extraterrestrial information he's included in Facts from Space, which was released October 1st. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dean, very good to see you this afternoon.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
You know, of all the things you're involved in, I had no idea that you were trying to become an aspiring author, that you wanted to write a book. How did that whole thing come about?
Well, this was kind of a strange situation because I'd been dabbling in writing a lot. I've been writing articles for Sky and Telescope magazine, for Astronomy magazine, for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And so I had ideas to put a book together, and I actually wrote a book before this one called Don't Trust the Astronomers, which unfortunately no publisher wanted up until now. So then this book came about when the publisher called me. It's a group called Adams Media, part of F&W, and they'd seen me on TV, read some of my writing, and said, you know, we want somebody to write a book of facts of astronomy, and we think you're the guy. So I was shopping this other, totally other book, and this one fell towards me, and I just said, whoa, yeah, this is perfect. It's right up my alley.
Don't trust the astronomers. So I guess you were looking at mistakes that astronomers have made.
Exactly. I picked some of the top mistakes astronomers had, and the ones that lasted the longest. Too, you know, hundreds of years or thousands of years, and then how we figured out the right answer.
And that didn't go through, so you have this book, Facts from Space.
We'll try that one next. So I still got it. So.
You still have hopes for that
one. That's right.
What was the whole process like for you to write this book, Dean?
Well, so in December is when, I agreed to do the book, and then it was a quick turnaround. So I had 3 months. It was my three months to write the manuscript for it. And so my goal was to make about 1,000 facts all told, and broke it up into chapters, starting with orbiting the Earth, manned missions, then go to the moon, then to the planets and the stars and beyond. And so the first 500 facts were a piece of cake. They were all in my brain. I'd been teaching this to kids for 16 years. It all came out. And then I got halfway done and I thought, uh-oh. I still have 500 more to go. And so I had to learn. And so that's when the research part began, right around in January. And so then I found some really cool oddball astronomy facts that I never knew before. And so this was a lot of fun to find some new stuff that I never had. And then we had to whittle them down from 1,000. I think I had about 1,100 by the end of it. And we whittled down to in the 800s or so. So it was about 800 facts.
So there were facts that had to be left out.
So there's a whole other book of facts that didn't make this cut. So we've got more in the bank for a future time.
The thing that when you reached that 500 point, you had to start digging to find some new things. You said you found some things that were surprising to you that you had never known before. Can you give me some examples?
The main ones for that was the humans in space part. There were such really weird anecdotes of our astronauts. You think of them very straight laced. They're sitting there in the rockets. They're heroes. All this stuff, but they were there's some goofy things. You know, there's one astronaut that smuggled a sandwich on board in his spacesuit, undetected. Another one, the Russian cosmonaut, his wife smuggled aboard a box of chocolates. And he opens the chocolates in space and they just float everywhere. And it took him 2 hours to collect them. When I say collect them, they probably ate them. It's kind of like if you saw that Simpsons episode when Homer goes into space and he's eating the potato chips. They were probably doing that,
floating
in space, eating chocolates as they're flying around. It's little stuff like that. It kind of makes you know, I try to make it a little more the human side to astronomy too. There's all these interesting characters.
Well, and you also have the story of the first astronaut to golf on the moon, which I believe was Alan Shepard.
Alan Shepard. That's right. And so the word is he smuggled everything on board. You know, I don't know where he put the golf club and where he put the golf ball, but you know, everything is weighted, so they make sure that they only bring so much weight, and because that's how much fuel you'll need to get there. And so he gets up on the moon, and his first shot was just awful. I mean, he barely touched it because he couldn't wrap his hands, or he couldn't put both hands.
Yeah, those spacesuits, they were bulky, weren't they?
Right, so he couldn't put both hands on the golf club. So the second or third shot, he said, Oh, did you see that? It went for miles and miles up there.
That sounds like a typical golf run. That's the kind of thing that I say when I go golf. Yeah, you see that shot I just made? It was great.
Exactly.
And you devote a chapter also to the first animals in space, mm-hmm. which is quite interesting. Now, what was the first animal?
Well, so the first one was a dog named Laika. And so this was a Soviet project where they launched animals into space in preparation for humans, just like the Americans did too. We mostly used monkeys, but the Russians used dogs initially. And so Laika was this stray dog from the streets of Moscow that they picked up, put a crash course on how to fly in space, and launched her up there. Now, this was the tragic part about it, is that there was such a race to be the first to do these things. So, you know, Sputnik 1 sent the first satellite around Earth, and then Sputnik 2 is the one that Laika went on, and unfortunately, they didn't make any preparations for her to get back safely. So she was one of the casualties of the space race, is that she died up in orbit. And this led to a lot of animal rights talk back then and in that time frame. It was really kind of a moment in that, all this from space travel. But then they had a lot of dogs that went up in space that successfully made it back, and even a kind of a zoo that went around the moon. It was like mealworms, turtles, all sorts of things, that they were the first things to fly around the moon before
any humans.
That was a Soviet space mission, yep. And so this little menagerie went around the moon and then came back, and the turtles were still just fine, apparently.
Why did the Russians prefer to use dogs? What was their reason? And the U.S., we used monkeys?
Yes. Well, what I read was that the dogs were easier to train, and they were also easier to use the restroom. They could use the restroom in any position, especially female dogs. So that's where most of them were female dogs. And so you think...
So they saw them as being more adaptable.
Exactly. But it's really... There is a really good story about Laika, you know, just that she was this dog on the street and picked up and then was in space all of a sudden.
So why the U.S. preference for monkeys is the other thing.
That's a good question. I don't know why that happened. I don't know why that was one way or the other. I didn't get into that one quite as much.
Because we thought maybe they were closer to humans and they would be a better example of how a human might react in space.
Right. That was the thought. I think they were squirrel monkeys, so they're very small. They weren't large creatures, though that helped out a little bit too. But that's part of the space program we don't hear as much about, is all these other creatures that went up there. I mean, actual literal guinea pigs went up there in space even before humans.
I thought it was neat what you were saying about the menagerie that went around them. What year was that?
I think it was in the 59 was the first time the Russians sent something around the backside of the moon. So somewhere right around there, or early 60s, because all of the moon features on the far side of the moon, these are the features you can't see from Earth. So from Earth, we can only see one half of the moon. And so before 1959, we had no idea what the other side of the moon looked like until this Russian spacecraft went around there, took pictures. And since they got there first, they got to name all the big things. So a lot of the craters on the far side of the moon have Russian names.
You know, I've always wondered, too, with all the missions, how much stuff got left behind on the moon. And you actually talk about that in the book.
Tons and tons and tons of stuff is up there in space. I mean, there's satellites, there's space trash that was ejected. I was sitting around with a friend this weekend and we were talking about, you know, meteors and shooting stars. And I said, you know, actually, when you see really bright shooting stars, it could be a meteor, or it could be space junk finally falling back down to Earth. That makes it less romantic to wish upon a space junk falling through Earth, but still there's a lot up there. And then on the moon, we left tons and tons of material up there. So we were a little bit of litter bugs up there on the moon, but it's all still there if we wanted to go up and get it.
I think your book said 400,000 pounds was the amount.
Right, and yeah. Only about 800 pounds of moon rocks we brought back. So it wasn't a fair trade. We left a little more on the moon than we took.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join the conversation with Dean Regas. His new book is called Facts from Space, From Super Secret Spacecraft to Volcanoes in Outer Space, Extraterrestrial Facts to Blow Your Mind. Okay, so what are some of those super secret spacecraft you're talking about?
This one is really cool. There is a super secret government spacecraft called X-37B. It's so secret they actually tried to rename it, and so now it's some other name I can't remember. But what happened was amateur astronomers track satellites. We track the space station. We track other satellites that are up there. And they started seeing this thing that nobody had ever seen before. And they started putting it on charts and said, okay, we don't know what this is, but it's circling around and here's where you can see it. And so they posted it on the internet. And eventually the government had to say, yeah, that's our craft, but don't ask us any more questions. So we don't really know much about it at all, but there is this thing, and you can't put one over on amateur astronomers. If something's up there, we're going to see it and we're going to talk about it.
And then it ends up in your book.
That's right. Exactly.
So in terms of where humans go next, I mean, President Obama just said, I think it was last week, that he'd like to see somebody, but he'd like to see a mission to Mars by 2030.
In the 2030s, yes.
In the 2030s. But what do you think? Do you think the moon comes before that again, or do you think we just go straight to Mars?
That's a tough one. I've been going back and forth on this one because, you know, we haven't been to the moon since 1972. So for almost 45 years, we have we haven't left low Earth orbit. It's going to take a little bit of practice. We've got to relearn a few things, I think, from the moon missions. It's such a big difference. It's a 3-day trip to the moon. It's a 7-month trip to Mars. This is a humongously big difference. And so I think there's a lot of practice we have to do. I could also see us just going for it. Say, okay, Mars is the place we want to go. Let's go for it. Let's get people there. And his goal is what I've been hearing. 2030s, 2035, 2039 is kind of a time frame we're looking for. But the important thing he said was we're going to bring them back. That's important. Not a one-way mission. It's a two-way mission.
Well, that's one of the difficulties of going to Mars, from what I understand. How long does it take to get there in the first place?
Yeah, so it's 7 months to get there.
Yeah.
1 year on the planet till the Earth comes back around, and then you should fly 7 months to get back home. So almost a 26-month trip just to go there and back. So it's 2 years of your life and very, very dangerous conditions.
And something else you write about in your book is the changes that happen to people when they're in space.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, because if you're in space, you're in microgravity, very little gravity for 7 months. Things happen to you. Your bones deteriorate. Your muscles deteriorate because just sitting here on Earth, you're using muscles. You're counteracting gravity up in space. You can exercise every day and you'll still will lose muscle mass. You get taller, though. That's the plus side. So
really?
there was that experiment with the two twins. The one twin went up in space for almost a year and his twin stayed here and they got back together and the one in space grew 2 inches. Because your spine is, you're able to stretch out a little bit.
You don't have gravity pulling you down.
That's right. That's right.
We will continue our conversation with Dean Regas about facts from space. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Regas and co-host of the public television series Stargazers joins me this afternoon. And his new book is Facts from Space, From Super Secret Spacecraft to Volcanoes in Outer Space, Extraterrestrial Facts to Blow Your Mind. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dean, it is really nice that you're in today, because we had a great one of those events you can actually observe with your eyes going on up in the skies, the full moon this week, and I think it was called a hunter's moon.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was pretty spectacular.
Oh, it was perfect. It was perfect weather here in the tri-state. We had this gorgeous giant moon rising up in the east. It's a almost the superest moon of the year. We're going to have a slightly closer one November 14th, so mark your calendars for that. But it was just great to see this giant moon rise up there and light up the tri-state. And I mean, it was super bright, too. So that's the thing. The moon changes its distance from us slightly. And so this was a super moon like this could be about 14% bigger than the farthest moon. So it's noticeable. So if you looked up there and you thought, whoa, that's a big moon, you are correct.
Wasn't there a point, what was it, about 13 years ago, where there was a rumor going around that said that Mars would actually appear larger than the moon? I think you referenced it in the book. What was that? What was
yes,
that all about?
The great Mars hoax. It was saying on August 27th, the planet Mars will look as big as the full moon in the sky. Yeah, total garbage. Nothing true about that. The Mars was closest to us as it ever will probably get is August 27th, 2003. So every year they would put this email hoax would go around on 2004, 2005, 2006 and say, yeah, this August 27th, it'll be so big and full. No, it was August 27th, 2003. And even then it wasn't as big as a full moon. It was looked as big as a full moon when you looked at it through a telescope.
Okay. So if this thing pops up again, don't believe it.
Don't forward it, please. Just delete it and say, nope, it is a hoax.
Not going to happen.
If Mars ever looks as big as the full moon, we're in big trouble.
I'd say, something has gone
yeah,
badly
I'd
wrong.
Say you better run. That's what you do.
How did you become such a big fan of astronomy, Dean?
Oh, it was kind of a total accident, actually. My background is in history and education, so I wanted to be a high school history teacher when I grew up. And then this kind of found me by accident. I was working for the Cincinnati Parks doing nature ed and working at Burnett Woods where the planetarium is. There's a very small planetarium there at the end of the lake. And I started working there and just fell in love with the subject. And just I'm a self-taught astronomer. I learned all this stuff from books and sky simulation software, and I just have a real passion for it. So like when I found this as a job, as a career, it was just I dove into it. I just loved it.
Okay, so I have to ask you, what's your favorite space movie, and what movie do you consider maybe to be the most accurate portrayal?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, I guess the stock answer is 2001 has to be the best, but lately there have been some pretty good ones. I really enjoyed Interstellar. I really did. I thought it was neat to see different planets, what it was like on different planets. I thought that was really cool, because usually when we see Star Wars and Star Trek, they all go to planets and they're all Earth-like. But in Interstellar, you got to see some really crazy planets. I really liked that part of it. The Martian was very good as well. I liked that, too. I would say I liked the book a little bit better than the movie, but I really enjoyed the book. So,
now, I have to know, is it Uranus or Uranus?
Yes.
Now, that's one of the great debates in astronomy, isn't it?
Very good question. How do you pronounce that planet? Well, both are acceptable. You can say Uranus or you can say Uranus. Both are acceptable in the astronomical community. However, what I recommend is you vary your pronunciation depending on the maturity of your audience. So if I'm talking to, let's say, a 6th, 7th, or 8th grader, I'm going to say Uranus. If I'm talking to a very adult, mature person, or kindergartners, I would say Uranus. That's my default one. That's what I always learned was Uranus.
Wasn't Uranus almost named George?
Oh, well, that's true. Exactly right. When the planet was found in 1781, it was William Herschel discovered it, and he wanted to name it after the King George. So it could have been George instead of Uranus, but they wanted to go with mythology in the end. So that won.
What's your book have to say about Pluto? I think you're I think you're on the Pluto is not a planet side, and never will be again.
I am very firmly in the Pluto is not a planet side. I'm sorry if that doesn't sell books. I'm sorry. Well, you could read the debate and then you can argue against it. But yeah, Pluto is one of those things that it's really a cool world. That's for sure. It was really great to see it up close with the New Horizons spacecraft last year. But it just doesn't fit in with the other eight planets. Those eight planets are such dominating forces. Pluto is where it is because Neptune moved it there. I mean, Neptune is the planet that shaped where Pluto is. And now we know so much about Pluto's neighborhood. There's thousands of other objects out there where Pluto lives. And that's what's pretty exciting. So
what was the one you wrote about? The Sedna?
Sedna. Sedna is my new favorite. So okay. move over Pluto. If you like Pluto, I got something better. Sedna is this object. It's about a little bit smaller than Pluto. And it goes around the sun once every 12,000 years. It is one of the only objects that does this, that's so far away from the sun. And it was really cool that we found it in the first place. And it might even lead us to other planets, other objects that are farther away from that. It's kind of gotten a couple astronomers thinking there's a hidden planet out there farther that made Sedna do what it did, just like Neptune did, how Neptune messed with Pluto. Something messed with Sedna, we're thinking. And so there could be another planet out there.
If you had to pick one fact in the book, Dean, that was the most fascinating or interesting to you, what would it be?
Well, so I'd say the ones that I liked the most writing was in the final chapter. My final chapter is called Deep Thoughts About Space. So we started on the Earth, and then we went farther and farther away to the edge of the galaxy. And then I ended the book with Deep Thoughts About Space. And so one of my favorite ones is about the universe. Is that there's this theory that there's multiple universes out there. And
it's called
the multiverse theory. And certainly there could be other universes out there. But by definition, there cannot be, because the universe, by definition, is everything. So if we ever see another universe out there, it becomes our universe. And I always like that.
That is a deep thought.
It's deep. I know. Think about that.
That is a deep thought. Yes. Well, the other, I think also in the deep thought section, you talked about how is the universe infinite or can it be measured? And you said it depends on what perspective you take. It's actually possible to measure it.
Exactly. Exactly. What's really neat is that we can make a map of the entire universe right now. We have this map, and when you look at it from our perspective, that's what it looks like. However, if you were outside, if you were God and you were looking down on the universe, it wouldn't look like our map. Our map is only our illusion of what it looks like from here. So boy, man, just when you think you got everything figured out, it's all just an illusion.
Also, something else that you mentioned in that section was what's happening to the Big Dipper. Is also rather fascinating and rather deep and mysterious, that the Big Dipper may not be the Big Dipper.
That's right.
At some point.
Yeah, astronomers get to think in really big chunks of time. And so all the stars, all the constellations we see today pretty much have remained unchanged for thousands of years. So the Egyptians saw the same constellation patterns we do. But if you go in the future, really, really far, 100,000 years in the future, the stars are shifting very slightly. And so the Big Dipper for your very distant ancestors will be looking like a big spatula. It'll still be recognizable, but look a lot different.
But that's tens of thousands of years out there, right?
Exactly. Okay. So for your entire lifetime, the Big Dipper will be the Big Dipper. But yeah, you can just kind of picture fast forward what all the stars will be a little different for our descendants.
And you got me curious too. Where will we look for aliens?
Look for aliens? Well, I think Mars is a really good place. I think there's at least a chance there could be life on Mars today, fossilized life possible. And then beyond that, I can't wait for us to go to Europa, the moon of Jupiter, drill through the ice in there, swim around the ocean, and see what looks back at us. I'm hoping. I'm crossing my fingers on Europa.
Well, and if they're watching us, what could aliens on a distant planet see? If they're looking back at Earthlings.
Well, so, when you look in space, you're also looking back in time. So if they hear any of our radio
signals.
That's
a deep thought in itself.
Yeah, so if they're listening into WVXU today, it's going to be a few years for some stars before they hear me say this. But greetings from Earth to all your aliens. but yeah, it takes time. So they could be listening back to old Cincinnati editions going way back. Or they could be watching our TV shows from reruns from MASH or from Gilligan's Island or something like that.
Do you see a big interest, Dean, in astronomy by kids today?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, I was at Books
so,
by the
so
Banks.
So the internet hasn't made it boring to them or anything?
Not at all, not at all. Okay. I was at Books by the Banks on Saturday, and I met a lot of people that were just like kids and families, and they're just so excited about the subject. It's they see pictures on the internet, and that gets them excited, but they still wanted to get books about it. They still wanted to like dive in. And there's a fifth grader that's one of our members at the observatory. His mom sent me a picture of him reading the book, and he's read the whole thing in one day. He's just like super excited about space. So it's great to see.
So what do you do as a follow up?
Well, so
you had all those leftover facts you were talking about earlier. So I really wonder.
Well, I'm gonna dust off the Don't Trust the Astronomer's book, and maybe I can find another. So the other one though that I have in my mind is to do a tour of the universe. To actually fly through these places, go to all these places and visit them up close and talk about what it would be like there. So that's the one that's on my mind, is a tour of the universe. So I've got to get to work on that one.
Dean, always fun talking to you. Thanks for being
here. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Cincinnati Observatory Assistant Director Dean Rieger and co-host of the public television series Stargazers. His new book is Facts from Space, from Super Secret Spacecraft to Volcanoes in Outer Space, Extraterrestrial Facts to Blow Your Mind. And I should note here that Dean will be at the Joseph Beth Booksellers in Rookwood Commons for a book signing Thursday, October 27th at 7 p.m. He'll also hold a book signing and reception at the Cincinnati Observatory on Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. And you can find links to more information about both events at wvxu.org.